Here at Early Excellence, we specialise in early childhood education. We offer expert advice and guidance through training, consultancy and classroom design. With the Early Excellence podcast, we aim to inspire and support you as well as challenge your thinking. So if that's what you're looking for, you've come to the right place. Hello everybody, Andy Burt here. We're taking a break from recording new episodes of the podcast at the minute, but we will be back with new Early Excellence podcast episodes in September. Until then, we'll be re-releasing some of our favourite episodes from the year so far. So here's my Early Excellence podcast chat with Karen Boardman as we explore early literacy in the EYFS. Karen, thank you very much for joining us. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Really privileged to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. It's an absolute pleasure. Now, your area of expertise is early literacy. So we're going to talk all about early literacy, a really interesting area of practice. And just to kick us off, I thought we'd start off, as we're talking about early literacy, I thought we'd start off with children's books. I have in my head a particular children's book that is my favourite, but I was really interested to know your favourite children's author or your favourite children's book. Would you be able to share that with us?
I certainly would. So I have three that I can't separate from each other, and it's because of the culture and the relationships that these books mean to me. So Dear Sue, Rod Campbell, is one of my favourites because my youngest son requested that constantly. And his daughter, my granddaughter, that's one of her favourite books. So that just makes me feel very, very complete. And Bear Hunt, obviously, because the illustration to Bear Hunt. But if you were to pinpoint me to one, it would be Tanker Tanker Skunk by Steve Webb. Steve Webb's an absolute genius. It's got rhyme, it's got rhythm, it's got a steady beat, it's got alliteration. Children can really, really join in that. So if you put me on the spot, that would be my favourite. But I can't separate the relationship building and the nurturing attachments from the other two.
No, that's really interesting. Yeah, I don't know that one, your favourite one. I don't know that one. Really interesting. Yeah. I wonder how many people listening know that one. But I'm always interested to know of new books that I haven't come across. But you're right. You know, it is about relationships, isn't it? You know, when we read with young children, it is about that building that relationship. It's not just what's on the page. It's not just the literacy skills. There is a holistic thing going on, which is about building the relationship as well, isn't there? And so when we think about our favourite books, we do think about times we read them and the moments that we shared and the look on the children's faces as they were absolutely drawn into it. There's an emotional thing that goes on, I think, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. And I could always pinpoint when we're going on a bear hunt, I could always read the pinpoint that my son would go to sleep. And we had to talk about the bear. So on the last page, the bear's walking away by himself. And we always had to talk about the bear. But the bear's very happy. The bear's going to make new friends. And, you know, halfway through that conversation, my son would go to sleep. I can't separate the emotion from the text, but obviously all of those texts are just wonderful experiences, beautifully written, and the illustrations are fabulous as well.
Yeah, definitely. I think in children's books as well, children's authors, I think, get a bit of a, I don't know, almost like a bit of a rough ride in a way, in that it's sort of, I think that it's a devalued part of sort of writing in a sense. Whereas actually when you think about, if you're writing a children's book, you have to be incredibly economical with the words that you're using. My favourite book is Where the Wild Things Are by Maurice Sendak, which again, for me, the illustrations absolutely draw you. I just find it, the pages where, Max, who's in his wolf suits, he gets sent to bed without any supper, and then his room, I'm trying to think of the wording of it, because the wording of it is so beautiful, but it's something like the walls became the world all around is one of the phrases that he uses. Basically, a private boat, a private boat appears, and that's not the wording, and an ocean tumbled by, and things like that. It's those sorts of wonderful kind of words and phrases that you think, well, actually, you didn't have 3 pages to describe that. You had just a few words to capture the absolute beauty of it. And I think for me, that's why I think children's books particularly are so special. You know, there's the economy of words, really, economical use of words that are so clever. Yeah.
We use Where the Wild Things Are for our induction activities here at the university for our students. We get them to role play it, act it out, make boxes. That's a favourite of ours for exactly what you've just talked about, Andy. The language, the emotion, what you're getting from that book is really powerful. So we introduce that day two when you join us here at the university.
Oh, that's brilliant. That is brilliant. And there's also kind of there's that relationship between print and illustration that I think is such a clever thing that children's authors use, that you have in Where the Wild Things Are, you have the print with the illustrations all the way through until the middle bit where Max has this wild rumpus. And so they him and Max and the monsters have this wild rumpus, and they rumpused, and there's just sort of three pages in a row where you kind of just have Max dancing with the author, with Max dancing with the monsters on this wild rumpus, but there's no print. And so it gives you the opportunity to, if you're the person reading it, to do something different in those moments, to have a bit of a dance or to move the book and to make up a bit of a kind of a rumpus song or whatever that might be.
Yes. And that's why we use that text in the beginning. Whilst we're talking about illustrations, I really like The Wave by Susie Lee, which is a wordless picture book. Those visual literacies. So when we're talking about illustrations, we use the phrase visual literacies, and the engagement that every child has with an image is completely different. So what one child sees in an image is completely different from what another child sees and what an adult sees. So we spend a lot of time looking at illustrations in picture books, looking at posters of forests, of the beach, of the sea, any scenes really, because that rhyme rhythm is just as much a part of the illustrations as it is the story.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, no, that is really interesting. As I say, the balance between print or no print and then illustrations, I think is really clever the way that children's authors do that. There are such a lot of wordless texts out there now, aren't there, that are very, very cleverly put together, cleverly written, if you like, in that, it draws you in to telling the story, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And I have the privilege of working with the United Kingdom Literacy Association on the long list to the short list, and short list to the finalists of new children's books. And that's really exciting. So we work with teachers in classroom who read the stories, and then we feed back. And there's every year there are wonderful books that have fabulous images, but also new characters for us to think about. So I could talk about books all day, Andy.
Yes. I wondered, actually, as I mentioned wordless books, do you feel that wordless books are valued as much as they should be?
Possibly not, but it would depend on your definition of reading and certainly your definition of early reading. I think telling a story from illustrations is much more powerful than telling a story with words, because they're someone else's words. But it's how we use those illustrations, isn't it? And it's, for me, visual literacy and literacy in general is about a holistic experience. I can't separate, and my research doesn't separate communication, language, from literacy, from writing, from rhythm, from steady beat, from rhyme. It's all part of the way that young children learn and communicate.
Absolutely. And interestingly as well, even in the conversation we've just had around books, that actually there is that breadth there, isn't there? That it's hard to even separate something like music from reading with young children, isn't it? You know, that I was sort of, as I was describing the kind of the wild rumpus from Where the Wild Things Are, you're getting into kind of making up your own musical part within that middle of that text. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, absolutely. Musicals, the BBC musical Storyland, I don't work for them, so I'm not advertising it for any other reason. If you haven't come across musical Storyland, that's beautifully an embodiment of about my definition, particularly about early reading. So it's got rhyme, rhythm, steady beat. It's got music woven throughout. And it's just so powerful. I think reading for many, many people, it doesn't matter whether you love it or you don't, or you engage in it or you don't, is so complex. And for me, I can't separate the language, the communication, the talking, the images from the words and the letters and the sounds.
Yeah, no, that's really interesting. Really, it is. I wanted to focus in on some research that I saw that you'd taken part in around reading from birth to three, and I thought it was really interesting what you pinpointed within it and the kind of the conversations that led to. Do you feel that, you know, when we're talking about reading with young children? We've obviously talked about the value of it already, but do you feel that there is a perception that reading happens more or should happen more from three onwards rather than from birth to three? I wondered what you'd found within your research.
That's a really interesting question. Thank you for asking that question. It leads me right into what I talk about all the time. This was part of a five-year research project, and the research project asked practitioners, teachers, and lots of senior leaders there was just one research question: how do you support under fives with early reading? And that was the research question. When I engaged in the research in the beginning, I had no idea what we're going to find, which is obviously the right reason to do research, is not really supposed to know the answer. But the very fact that so many people completed the initial survey led me to believe that, oh gosh, this is really interesting for practitioners. And because we've not got all day, I'll be really quick about the synopsis from the research project. So reading for practitioners and teachers that work with under fives is predominantly about teaching phonics. So that's their understanding. It's about teaching phonics and delivering phonics. And those practitioners that work with babies and infants, so under threes, don't consider themselves to be practitioners that think about reading. Reading is something for those practitioners that is left to school, which was so fascinating. because the data contradicted itself. So we have the views from practitioners and teachers that don't think that they're able to best support reading, yet the reflective scenes that they completed, so that's just a blank sheet of paper with the research question on, those reflective scenes absolutely gave all of the data that everyone supports children's reading. So there are books in the baby room, there's story time happening. And it made me feel really sad that the practitioners that work with our youngest children don't feel supported enough or know enough about early reading.
So you're saying that it does happen, but people's perception of it is that they don't do it or they don't do it enough. Is that yeah. right? Have I understood that?
Yeah, so it does happen and they're not thinking about it. It's coming naturally to them. They are singing nursery rhymes. They are doing rhythm, going on listening walks, all of those things, and they don't consider those activities to be under the umbrella of reading.
Is that because of that? Did you get a sense that was because of that link between what we call reading and what we call phonics, and that actually there's been a blurring of the two? Did you feel that, you know, that are people saying, well, actually, you know, we don't feel that we do it, and whilst the question was reading, what they're talking about is their perception of phonics, whereas actually they do both of those things, but within a very early context.
Yes, all of those things. So the top-down heavy approach, which at School of Education we've heard all this, Peter Moss talks about this quite a lot. They felt that they were doing the right thing and getting children ready to read by teaching phonics, which, as those of us that research literacy know, that phonics has its place, it's wonderful, but not until children really understand the relationship with letters and sounds and in the play-based environment. So, yeah, there was a lot going on in the research, and I'm still writing about some of the aspects at the moment because it is so complex.
Yeah, it is really interesting. Our perception of whether it's happening is a really interesting thing, isn't it? Particularly if people feel that it isn't happening when it actually is. It makes me wonder whether actually people feel satisfied with what they're doing, even though they're doing, actually could be well doing a very good job, they just don't feel satisfied with it. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. It makes perfect sense. So those practitioners that are working with the youngest or babies felt pressure that sitting and doing what they would call doing nothing, so reading with children, would be seen as a negative by nursery managers, nursery leaders, because they, you know, they've got nappies to change, they've got the care aspects. There was a lot of care versus education conversations in the data, which doesn't surprise me, but I didn't realise it influenced reading at all, and whether they engage with reading. And that also came up with nursery and reception, that if they're sitting reading with a child, small groups of children, what are their counterparts thinking that they should be doing? So it's that value we place on reading, again, which is really complicated. So some of the data talked about herding sheep at story time. I talk a lot with reception teachers about this. When we choose story time, Is it when just before lunch or just before we go home, in which case are you placing a value on story time or are you herding sheep? The children know the next thing is important, but they also know that they want you there. You want them there, sorry, for story, for a reason. So I always talk to reception teachers when I can in any training I'm delivering, which is about let's put the value on story time back, let's put it somewhere else, and think about what else we can do at the end of the day when we are herding sheep. Now, that isn't my, I've stolen it from a head teacher that was involved in the research, but they're not my words.
Yes. So it's thinking about the quality of it.
Yes, it is.
Yeah, I think you're right. I also think there's a perception that, you know, if we were to say, you know, tell me about storytelling in your setting, I think people would think naturally about that kind of reading time, you know, that sort of whole group or whole class sharing a story. That's when storytelling happens. Whereas actually storytelling, of course, could happen any time. And if the children just see storytelling as something that happens when somebody picks up a book, then maybe less inclined to think about themselves as storytellers. Whereas actually, of course, every child can tell stories, and they do as part of what they're doing all of the time.
Yeah. Story time happens during block play. Story time happens when children are outside, when they're finding things in the natural environment. Story time happens all the time. And we just need to think about the value we're placing on that. I mean, we have busy timetables in schools, don't we? And we have busy days in nurseries. And what we do at the university is try really hard to support our practitioners so that they understand what early reading is. As it might surprise you, Andy, but there isn't any lockdown version of early reading or reading. They are both concepts like play that is can be judged in any way, shape or form. So my research does focus on early reading as a definition that is about language communication. It's about social, holistic. It's about playing in puddles in the water, puddle jumping. It's about eye tracking activities, music, steady beat. It's everything that we do with our young children.
It is that broad picture. In fact, that brings us very nicely on to the next thing I was going to ask you about. And that is sort of thinking about early literacy. So not specifically reading, but early literacy in a more general way. Do we have a perception, do you think, that literacy happens in some areas of provision or in some contexts, perhaps more than others? You touched on that already, but it's an interesting thing to think about, isn't it? Do we think about literacy happening more in some areas of provision than others? Do we think about literacy happening maybe more inside than outside? I wondered whether your experiences or your research had kind of, I suppose, shone any light on that.
Yes, it varies really. So I think literacy, if you're thinking about print-based literacy, as in reading and writing, does tend to happen more indoors. So children playing with water, children playing with sand doesn't naturally lend itself to being a literacy activity where I consider that I'm a literacy advocate in everything that I do. So literacy is in every aspect of our routine, every aspect of our curriculum. So I talk about when you're changing nappies with children, it is about literacy, it is about the communication, the talking, singing songs, comforting children. Everything that we do is about literacy. And when we think and we reflect on that and we rethink about it, it does offer a different perspective, and indoors more than outdoors. So I do a lot of work with practitioners about literacy outdoors, and it is all of those natural experiences that children have. As I've said, puddle jumping, which is important, weaving, which supports children's writing, wild weaving, using huge plungers, all those huge physical activities that support children with that print-based reading and writing that they will need. Nobody denies they do need that, but that's not what it's about. For young children, experiences need to be meaningful and relevant to them.
Yeah. Interestingly as well, the things that you talked about then were generally sensory experiences. And I wondered about that link between the kind of the literacy skills and also the language and the sensory experiences, you know, puddle jumping, splashing in puddles, even just being outdoors in different weathers. it's a sensory experience, isn't it? And I've certainly read that there is a link between the sensory experiences and the language development. But of course, you could broaden that towards sensory experiences and literacy in a more general way. That would you say? Is that right? Yeah.
I would absolutely say that all literacy experiences are highly sensory based and holistic. And my next research project is about supporting parents, carers and families outdoors with literacy. So we're going to work with an outdoor, I don't know if I'm allowed to name them, so I shan't, an outdoor experience, you know, well-known centre, Martin Meyer. So we're going to work with Martin Meyer here in Lancashire and do some workshops with parents, carers and families about why they're visiting the centre, what they're doing, and we're going to try and focus in on literacy specifically. And we're going to make a resource to support the parents, carers and families. So I'm quite excited about that because I think there's much more to focus on outdoors to support children's literacy experience because it's all sensory, isn't it?
It is, yeah. But I think sometimes when people try to make their outdoor space more literacy rich, they end up doing things that sometimes are not practical. So, for example, things like trying to put laminated words or letters on a fence outdoors in an outdoor area, it takes a lot of time to do. It takes up a fair amount of time. It also sort of takes up, you know, resourcing as well in terms of kind of using laminated pouches and all of those kinds of things. And it doesn't tend to last. You know, it just, you know, they will blow away or the rain will go through them or whatever else. It doesn't tend to last. And I think we sort of have this tendency to try to see literacy as something that we can sort of add to a space as almost like as wallpaper rather than to think about the simple experiences of, as you say, splashing in a puddle or puddle jumping or the sensory experiences as already being literacy rich and that we can be part of that rather than thinking about, well, what do I need to add around the space visually?
Exactly that. And I do work quite a lot with practitioners and settings. We have knowledge exchange activities here at the university. And I do strongly endorse that you don't need to have letters and sounds outside. You can, you know, the experiences that are there are literacy experiences. Children will naturally get involved in literacy experiences like stamping, clapping, listening to sounds, finding objects, matching objects, shadows, wild weaving, all of those things are already literacy experiences. So I do quite often say, don't take your indoors, outdoors. It does need to be something completely different for young children that they cannot experience indoors. So just reflecting on and asking practitioners, teachers and senior leaders, okay, well, what do we offer outside that is supporting children's literacy? And you'll be amazed at how quickly they come up with a great big list. So they do know this already. It's just asking them to rethink about what young children do in those spaces.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. As I was looking into your research and as I was reading up on the research that you'd already taken part in and been engaged in and already published, it made me think of a quote that I use quite often on training. Now, I'm paraphrasing because I haven't got the quote in front of me, but Helen Bromley, who was a curriculum consultant who really specialised in literacy, sadly, she's no longer with us, but she talked a lot about, there's one particular phrase that she used. She uses this phrase that teachers and practitioners in the early years have the ability to decide what counts as writing for young children. Okay, so what counts as writing? And when I read that, it really got me thinking, because I think I see that quite a lot, where there are certain things that count that are counted as writing by teachers and practitioners, and other things that are not counted as writing. So we might display certain things that we say, well, look at our writing, this counts as writing. And then other things that are also actually about putting pencil to paper or making, you know, printing in some way, but actually we don't count them as writing. And I wondered about your take on that, what your thoughts were on that.
Multiliteracies are really, really pivotal. And Paul and Roswell in 2005 and 2008 talk about how children use the space, whatever they're creating, whether that be indoors or outdoors. Children are communicating, and play is pivotal to encourage that high order thinking of how children use mark making, and how that does leads to children's writing in a more formal way. But the most important aspect is the mark making. And I include Helen's work in a lot of the things that I talk about when I do talk about mark making. So we know that mark making is an embodied engagement experience. We use our whole bodies to do that. We think about emergent literacy, which begins from birth. Then we think about symbols making meaning. And language is foundational. Communication is foundational here. And moving into transcription, shapes of letters, composition, generating a message, all of those things happen during play and across all areas of learning. So graphical representations in mathematics, I could literally go on and on and on here. I do think mark making is powerful for encouraging children's creativity. And the more imagination time we give children to have to be creative with mark making, whatever that looks like, inside or outside, it's really, really powerful to get children's thinking.
Yes. It's also, of course, a great way to embed the skills that you have taught children. You know, that if you have taught them a particular skill in terms of writing and you want to know whether they definitely have it or not, then go back to the mark making and see whether it's coming through in their mark making. Because children will go through all of those different developmental stages and they'll need to embed that learning. And if they haven't got it, then you do need to keep going with it and teach it again.
Yeah.
Whereas if they have got it, you're giving them the opportunity to try that out, to play with it, to make sense of it, to use it in meaningful context, well, contexts that are meaningful to them. And so, of course, that's really important, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, there's nothing more powerful than a children's drawing. Absolutely. So every time I visit a nursery setting, and I do quite often in my role, nursery and reception, I'm always given a drawing, which I absolutely love. I don't know what I've done to deserve that drawing, but I love that. And they're in my office, they're everywhere. I'm fascinated by how children use their space in their mark making, you know, whether they start in the middle, at the end. I'm absolutely fascinated by that. And the more experiences we can give them outdoors as well with mark making, using pebbles, using leaves, using all the natural resources we've got. And it is whether you consider that to be mark making or something different.
Absolutely. This is all really, really interesting stuff. You mentioned earlier on that you've got other projects that are coming up. And so I thought, as we sort of start to draw things together, I wondered, first of all, about, you know, what have you got coming up? You know, what's next for you in terms of research and the work that you're doing? But also, alongside that, I'm sure that there are lots of people listening to the podcast who are absolutely, you know, absolutely drawn into what you are saying and completely get the importance of what you're saying. And I wondered whether that you could... whether you could signpost them to some of your work, if that's all right.
Yes, of course. So I currently have a book with Sage, Early Literacy for Under Fives. This was came out in January 2024. I'm really proud of it because it's me. So if you don't like me, don't buy it. that's my advice. I'm within it throughout it. But also the voices of the practitioners, I think it's 326 practitioners in total. The voices are absolutely throughout that book.
That's a major piece of research, isn't it? When you're talking about over 300 people involved in that process, that's huge, isn't it? When you think that actually sometimes, you know, you read some research, and I can think of some things that are coming out at the moment, where when you get to the bottom of it, there were, you know, sort of not that many teachers or practitioners involved. You know, you're talking about 12 people or something like that. 326 practitioners or teachers, that's a major, major piece of work.
Yeah. And I can't get them to stop researching, Andy. So those practitioners and teachers that started the reflective zines, they're still doing them. They've turned into floor books. So I get invited back. So it's like opening a can of worms. I've opened it and they don't want to stop, which is absolutely wonderful. So there'll be more on the Early Literacy Project because I get more data all the time. We also have research circles here at the university, which are quite unique in the way that we use them. They're based on Pearson's Swedish model of a research circle. I'm really passionate about research not being done to, research collaborating, everybody's voice needing to be heard for ethical reasons, as well as, well, you're not going to get the best out of any research if everyone's not fully involved. So that's why the circle's important, no hierarchy. So we've got research circles that are focused on communication, language and literacy, which is everybody's concern at the moment, isn't it, particularly post-COVID. So we're talking about strategies, to oracy really, about language, you know, talking bubbles, talking partners, talking nests, all of the ways we can encourage children to talk to us and communicate. And then there's the outdoor literacy project that is coming up. We have other research circles that are not based on literacy. So we've got one on attendance, which is another area of regulatory concern, attendance in reception classrooms. And I continue to write for Siren Films, but their
That's
blogs.
Fantastic.
Yep, I write for The Conversation. And I'm working internationally on a project, which is with a British school in Kuwait on the enabling environment. So we've redesigned the environment for small children. So lots going on, really.
You're a busy person, Karen. That sounds amazing. Yeah, no, it sounds amazing. Yeah. But what comes across, and I'm sure people who are listening to this will absolutely agree with me, what comes across is absolutely your passion for it. You know, from that very big, you know, that first thing that we talked about, you know, your favorite books and how actually you haven't just got one, you've got three that you can't actually, you know, you can't possibly separate out. You know, you've got that real passion for the whole process there and the depth there. That this isn't just about phonics, is it? You know, this is about that bigger picture of really understanding how young children learn, and that actually it's not really one strand by itself, you know, literacy, but actually it's that bigger picture, that holistic picture that is so important. Karen, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast. It's been wonderful to talk to you. Thank you so much.
You're very welcome. It's lovely to have your views. It's really lovely to hear your take on literacy, and yet you're right, it is my passion, and sometimes I bore people silly with it, so I'm glad you found it interesting.
Well, you haven't done today. It's been wonderful. Thank you so much.
Oh, thank you.
So there you go. Thank you very much to Karen for joining us on the podcast this week. Definitely lots there to get us thinking about early literacy. And thank you, of course, to you people for listening along as well. That's about it from us for this week. Have a good week, everybody, and we will see you next time.